My name is Mike Matuzzi, and I'm the host of Contemporary Spirituality Today. Today we're visiting with a local lawyer, John Kurtz. I've had the pleasure over my career of having many cases with John Kurtz. He is not only an exceptional trial lawyer, but he is ethical, he is honest, and just delightful to work with. So before we started, we've been visiting a little bit, and I kidded him. I haven't had a case with him in so long, and I like having cases with him because he's fun to work with. I had to set up this interview to, you know, so I could spend some time with him. So here we are. John, tell our listeners a little bit about your life, where you grew up, and, you know, what, if any, experiences there were formative in terms of your spiritual journey.
Thank you, Mike, very much. I appreciate the chance to visit with you, and not to just stroke you, but I do want to begin by saying that you and I, although being always on the opposite sides of cases, it's always been mutually, I trust, certainly from you to me, it has been very polite, very professional, very respectful, every single thing. And that's kind of rare in the law practice in this day and age, in my estimation. So I thank you for every bit of that. I was born May 7, 1947 in Maryville, Missouri, Northwest Missouri, population about 6,500. I was very, very fortunate to grow up in that small town for the first 10 years of my life. It formed me in so many, many ways, and I was born into a family with a sister who was 13 years older than me, who was saintly and is still alive yet today in her 80s. And my mother and father were magnificent people. We went to the First Presbyterian Church in Maryville, Missouri, and we were there on Sundays, and my dad played some golf on some Sundays, but my mother was always there. My dad was frequently there, and that started a spiritual journey, I would say, and going back to grandparental generation, they were people of faith, people of belief, and people who lived, I think, the gospel, more so than talked it, probably it'd be right to say, and probably that's something that I saw them do, and probably the way that I have done it to a certain extent is to not to have religion on the shirt sleeves very much, but and I think I'd mentioned to you, Mike, earlier that, as you pointed out to me, it was St. Francis of Assisi saying about preach the gospel everywhere you go all the time, but only with words if necessary, or something to that basic effect, and which is to live the message, live your life, and let people see that you are, for you and me, that you're living the Christian message. And with the love of Christ and the love your neighbor as yourself and 1 Corinthians 13 style love. And so that is what I have tried to do. That's what I felt that I was brought up to do. And it's something I want to do with my life and have wanted to do through all the years and try to do. But as indicated, much more by actions rather than words.
Right. Well, and objective data on actions. I'm looking at your website, John, Honors and Awards, Pro Bono Award, Missouri Bar, H. Michael Cochran Community Service Award, Tom Cochran Community Service Award, Coburn Professional Excellence Award, Man of La Mancha Award for Dreaming the Impossible Dream, Fighting the Unconquerable Foe, UMKC Law Foundation. Let's talk about service, and I mean, I think anybody that knows you know that you walk the walk. I want to move to a different issue. Let's talk about race. You know, you've spent much of your time walking the walk there. Why? Why has that become so important to you?
Growing up in Maryville, Missouri, my recollection is there was one black family, and what I recall is that was no big deal, but I may have missed something there. But when I was 10 years old, we're moving to Columbia, Missouri, and some kid comes up to me and says, "Hey, Kurt, you're moving to Columbia. You're going to be going to school with Negroes down there," and says it that way in a very derogatory way. And I thought, what's with that? So I went to my mother, and my mother's a saintly lady, wonderful, wonderful Christian lady, very, very much. And she gave the most succinct an immediate answer that I could imagine anyone giving to that, and it set me on a path for the rest of my life. When I told her what had been said to me about going to school with Negroes, my mother did not go into some big pause, Johnny, let's go sit down now. Oh, we need to talk about this. This is a big, deep, serious issue. No, she immediately said, yeah, they're kids just like you. And man, that was a statement of equality. And I remember that so very, very well. And I remember all angst going out of me. It's nothing. It is nothing. And so we went to Columbia. Sure enough, the schools were integrated. And it was no big deal because they're kids just like me. And for that saintly lady, whose name was Mary Ray Kurtz, to have said that to me meant the world to me. And so then my father had one particular instance that quite as dramatic, but it was very meaningful to me. We're out playing some golf, and my dad always laughed with his buddies. This story that I tell you now is the only time that I ever saw my dad refuse to laugh with his buddies. This guy was out there, and he pulled out a golf ball from his bag that he was going to use, except it was all blackened and dirty from having been in a lake, I think. And he says to my dad, look at this goddamn Medgar Evers golf ball. I'm going to throw it back in the lake. And then he laughed big time. My dad turned his back on that man and walked away. And it conveyed a message to me, just like my mother had conveyed to me. So I see those things and I take those things in. And then we go through the 60s, and I didn't go to the South to march or anything like that. When I was drafted into the Army, I saw that the Army was overpopulated with African Americans, in my estimation, much more so than the populace at large. And somehow I saw that an awful lot of Caucasians were evading the Army and not getting in the Army. And here's this large number of African Americans serving in the Army. And I was moved by that, touched by that, hurt by that. And it made a difference to me. But I yet had not done something above and beyond. There was a Black Panther there who I became friends with and helped and worked with and so on. So it made some kind of a stamp. And I had been to the University of Pennsylvania studying social work and got a master's degree in criminology and after undergraduate and before law school. And so these things are all kind of out there happening. So then I go to law school, and I hate law school. And the first semester, the torch teacher put a big dollar sign on the bulletin board on the blackboard and said, here's what the entire thing is about. Here's what your whole experience. Here's what you all are doing here. And I thought, that's not what I'm doing here. And he said, if you're thinking about justice, just talk to your minister or something like that. And I guess in a certain way, that's what I did. In that after 3 years of law school, I said, I don't want to do this. I do not want to do this at all. I hate it. And so I found the job in Kansas City in the area of 28th and Prospect, 28th and Benton at St. Augustine's Episcopal Church, an all African American church. And I moved there to that area in basically 27th and Prospect and lived there for 5 years from 76 to 81. During all the years I worked at the church, during the years I was a public defender, during the years I started the Popham Law Firm. That's where I lived, on the third floor of a school teacher's home. And and I want to tell one story out of that too, if you allow me to. I thought I was the only Caucasian there, and then there was I found a lady who lived down the street named Eunice Candler, Candler, and I thought, well, she's a Caucasian. Well, she's still living here. She's the only one who didn't move out. Everybody else moved out. And so I thought, well, I'd like to know why. So one day I'm down at Miss Candler's house, and I'm thinking there must be something remarkable about her, this Caucasian, to not move. I said, Miss Candler, how long have you lived here? She said, this is 1978. She said, it's 1932. I said, but you never moved. She said, no, I never did. I said, ma'am, why didn't you move? And she said, well, you see, the Websters were the best neighbors I ever had. That was her next door neighbor, Tom and Fern Webster. Tom Webster had been a classmate of Thurgood Marshall at Lincoln University in Pennsylvania. And I've spoke at an NAACP meeting one time, and I said how much I regretted and apologized for the fact that there were not more Caucasian residents like Eunice Candler who gave their new next-door neighbors a chance to be the best neighbors they ever had. So anyway, I went to this church and worked there from the years 76, 77, 78. I got 20 godchildren by baptism at the baptismal fount, but I counted as 114 that I'm still in touch with yet today. And I've put girls through parochial high schools and a boy, and I've put two through college. I've walked two down the aisle to be married. Paralegal in our office today after 23 years here is who's 56 years old now, is my goddaughter. And so it has meant a great deal to me to have the opportunity. And and one thing I would say too, and this is I through the early years of my life, even moving in Columbia, I kind of confessed to this. When I would be talking to a person of color, somewhere in my mind would be, I'm talking to a person of color. It would just be there. I had the wonderful opportunity to live in an area where it was just Miss Candler and me. And it was ridiculous for me to be sitting around thinking I'm talking to a person of color. And by the grace of God, I was given the opportunity to extinguish that from my mind. It became no part of it. So I'm grateful to God for having been given the opportunity to serve a church there in the urban core of Kansas City, and to have all of these kind of like family members who are my family, and a number of us use the term father and son, father and daughter.
Beautiful. Let's move to career. So many of us really have to kind of compartmentalize to some extent to do this, because there can be so many mixed motives and things pulling you in different directions. I'm talking about civil trial work now. You, John, have done this for, I don't know, 40 years, rough math, probably more, but 16 years with the Poppin Law Firm, 23 years with your present firm that you started with Hubbard. Just unpack how you do that, how you bring your spirituality to the practice, and just to give people an intro. Here's your heading. We strive to bring justice for those who have been hurt and those whose lives have been damaged by the wrongdoing of others.
Yes, thank you. I don't try to preach it too much as I say, but I have felt as though I need to kind of be able to say some things sometimes. So on the years ago, 20 plus years ago, I said, well, I want a little logo here whenever I send an email to anybody. And on there, I have a small sparrow. And beside that, I have the words, his eyes on the sparrow. And I want people to know that. I want people to feel that. And as a plaintiff's lawyer, I'd probably say, my people, the people I represent, are the sparrows in the world in so many, many instances. And feeling on the downside of things and that they're small and so on. But I want them to feel that that God is with them and watching out over them. And then on my business card, I put this on there 23 years ago, and it's on the back of it. It says, rejoice in your hope, be patient in tribulation, Romans 12:12. And I got to say, I have those two things that are always there. When I hand out a business card, there that is. When I send an email, there that is. I'm not that comfortable just talking Christ, God stuff to complete strangers or things. I'd rather live it. And back to that St. Francis of Assisi, I'd rather live it and have it seen in works and actions and love. But I do have those two things which do kind of tend to communicate where I'm coming from and where we try and come from here. And then I try to, in the handling of cases and in the disposition of cases and the handling of fees and so on, I try to convey to people that they're the important ones. I'm not. And I'm a vehicle to try and get something for them. And I want it to I want them to feel like they got a special treatment, and so that's what I try and do. And I hope they get the message. I do hope they get the message that it comes from a Christian, I would say. And it's just I don't verbalize it that much, but they see it on the card, they see it on the email. And I'm emailing clients all the time, and I hope they see it in the way that I interact with them, as well as the way that I interact with even people on the other side.
Absolutely. And as I shared with you this morning, One of the reasons, even though we haven't had a case in a while, that I called you is several lawyers have said call John Kurtz. So, you know, further evidence of your ability to communicate your faith just in the way you act and carry yourself. Let's move to John Wesley and felt my heart strongly warmed. You told me that. Unpack that for us.
Yeah, I think it's strangely warmed. I remember when I worked for the United Methodist Church. It was actually the Evangelical United Brethren merging with the United Methodist Church in Appalachia in the summer of 1968 when I was in college. I remember there were some very religious people down there who said who were asking me some of these very heavily religious questions, like, tell me about your conversion, John. To me, they would say it, and I had no answer for that. I didn't remember being unconverted. I didn't remember a moment of being a jerk and then suddenly, oh, now I'm a Christian. I didn't remember that. I still don't, I guess. And so, and there were things like that, and also things about wanting to know if I heard voices and when I speak directly to God and a whole bunch of those things. They were just not things that I'm familiar with, although I'm still speaking to God in prayer. I'm familiar with that. But anyway, I was asked those questions. Well, sometime thereafter, oh, and I just remembered it, on Aldersgate Street, that because in the Methodist Church there's a lot of groups that are called Aldersgate. John Wesley, in something like the year, I don't know, 1738, he wrote and described his so-called conversion experience. And what he wrote was, we were in a group studying the Bible in a house on Aldersgate Street in London. And as the speaker was, and I'm so sorry, I can't remember the exact verse, as the speaker was addressing something like Romans or Corinthians or something, John Wesley wrote, I felt my heart strangely warm. And I thought, that I identify with, that I can talk about, you know. That I have the sense. And, I had the sense when my mother told me, they're kids just like you, when my dad walked away, when all of these various things in life and things that my grandmother said to me and so on, I would feel my heart strangely warmed. And I feel that it was a closeness to God, a closeness to Christ. And I have had my heart strangely warmed within the courtroom. I've had it strangely warmed in interactions with clients, and I feel that it is an expression of faith. It's a religious experience. I think it's Christ involved. I think it's God involved. And so the description of having one's heart strangely warmed is mine. I mean, that's the one. Well, it was John Wesley and me and a whole bunch of others, I think. And I'm not saying that anybody else's at all. Anybody else's religious experience and or conversion and or hearing voices, whatever else is wrong. I do not criticize anyone for theirs. I just know that I was grateful to learn of that experience from John Wesley's writings. And what a magnificent expression of a communication with a greater force of the Almighty.
Yes. Related topic, you are a great storyteller and a great story collector. I think you told me you've got buckets of favorite stories, you know, A through Z around or in your basement or something. But history is important to you. I know Lincoln's an important figure. Eisenhower story is important to you. Maybe just pick one of those two that is memorable, is of some significance.
Well, the Lincoln, when I think about Lincoln, and he was a man who was evolving always. And back, let me do one more thing on race. Lincoln met with Frederick Douglass in the 1800s. And Frederick Douglass wrote, he said, when I met Abraham Lincoln, he was the first person that I had ever met who appeared to me to have no consciousness of him and me being different races. Zero. And I thought, my God, I mean, my God. So we sit and we are in awe of this guy who in the 1860s decided slavery needs to go. It needs to go, and I'm going to stay with it. I know when he told his cabinet in the autumn of 1862, on January the 1st, 1863, I'm going to issue the Emancipation Proclamation. Here it is. I invite you to comment on it in terms of the wording of it or whatever else, but I'm going to give it. There was no doubt. He was going to do that. And so, you know, in terms of God-driven, and I know that he was not that much of a churchman, but he made great references to the Almighty and the better angels of our nature and so on. And then a small one that I did mention to you is that in 1864, he was running for re-election, and a group called the Missouri Committee of 20 asked him to do some political favor for them, and he declined. And they wrote to him and said, you understand this is going to cost you votes in the 64 election. And he wrote back a very courteous, classic Lincoln-type letter, and he said, I so desire to handle the affairs of this administration that if, when the time comes for me to lay down the reins of power, I have no other friends left on the face of this earth, I shall at least have one friend, and that friend shall be deep inside of me. And, of course, he's talking about his conscience. I think he's talking about his faith, and I think he was a very faith-based man. And I have pictures of him all over the office here, and I can get misty thinking about Lincoln and thinking about what he did and the courage that it had, and, of course, that he paid for it with his life, as have others. And I think he was very much in touch with his creator and our creator. And so I adore the man.
Yeah. I don't know if surely you know this because the data you have on historical things is deep. But Pope Francis, I think, spoke to Congress years ago, and he identified four figures who made a significant contribution from America. And four figures for Martin Luther King, makes sense, right? Dorothy Day, Catholic Welfare Program, Thomas Merton, great mystic, and Lincoln. So just interesting that would be the four pack that Pope Francis would identify. Tell us about the Manon Brennan story that is, I think, a good one. And I think it has special significance to you and the way you live your life.
Very much. I do have attended live, and then I do sometimes on the television set, the Church of the Resurrection with Reverend Adam Hamilton, and he tells wonderful stories and tells them very vividly. And so here's one of his stories that made an impact upon me. There were two fellows, last names Manning and Brennan. They were in a foxhole in Korea, and they were passing a candy wrapper back and forth, and unbeknownst to Manning, a grenade was thrown into the foxhole, and Brennan jumped on top of it, and that caused Manning to look, and Manning turned, and he saw Brennan with the grenade basically under his stomach, and at that moment in time, Manning said that Brennan winked at him and then was immediately blown to bits. And so Brennan was killed. Manning was spared. And Manning was so deeply moved by his dear friend Brennan that gave his life for him that when he was discharged from the Army, the first thing he did was, and I think I have these names exactly correct, changed his first name to Brennan Manning. He became Brennan Manning, and he became Father Brennan Manning, a Catholic priest, and he did that because he wanted always to honor and remember this man who had given his life that he, Manning, might live. And when Adam Hamilton tells that story, his P.S. to that story, which is a giantly meaningful P.S., as he said, and so it is likewise with those of us that call ourselves Christians, and that we have taken the name as a group of someone who gave their life for us.
Beautiful. All right, let's get back to the 114, and that's the group, I think, of children or predominantly children that you worked with in the inner city 3 years ago, and you kind of identified 20 godchildren, too, I think, that you walked down the aisle. Tell us more about one of the young ladies that asked you to walk her down the aisle who didn't have a father figure, and the marriage didn't work out, but you've really stayed in touch with her. Tell us about that.
Right. This particular child is African-American. She was adopted at birth by an adoptive mother. There was no adoptive father. Her mother was a wonderful lady. Her adoptive mother was a wonderful lady. But she was killed in an automobile collision about 20 years ago. This lady is now 35 years of age that I'm talking about. And so I represented the family at that time. And I liked the little girl. A great deal. I've looked back and found that I did waive fee on the case, which I just because I was moved by them and I felt they needed all the money. I didn't need any of that money. She, a few years later, got back in touch with me and said, "I'm going to get married here in Texas. Would you come down and walk me down the aisle?" And I said, "Well, sure." And I was touched by that. I thought it was a magnificent gesture, and I thought it was going to be great fun. I have walked two other girls down the aisle, and I love doing that. It's in a fatherly way. Well, it turned out the wedding didn't work out. And plus, I had kind of thought, you know, I know her, but do I know her that well? Her selecting me for that. And I will tell you that I've spent now a number of, for the last several years apologizing to her for not picking up at that time how much she wanted someone to serve as a father for her. About 2.5 years ago, she made a trip up here to Kansas City. We'll talk on the phone and email and so on. She made a trip up to Kansas City, and we had a lunch together, and it was a very pretty deep conversation where I came to understand how much she wanted a father, because she had never ever had anyone who acted as a father to her. And so I said, "Oh, I'll do that. I want to do that." And then I told her a John Wesley story, which was that John Wesley was one of 17 children. 10 of them made it through infancy. His mother, Susanna Wesley, and again, this founder of the Methodist Church, his mother, Susanna Wesley, wanted to give time for each of the children. And Thursday night was his time with his mother. And after supper, and it remained a special time for him all of his life because his mother gave him that special time. So with this girl, one of the things we did was when we decided, oh no, we're into father-daughter. We are deep into father-daughter now. I said, "I'm going to write to you every Thursday from now on for the rest of my life until I die." And I've written 118 messages. Last Thursday was number 118, once a week. She's 35. She has a bachelor's degree. She has 2 master's degree, and she's a PhD candidate, but she had no father. We go on and on about father-daughter and saying to each other, "How can I be a better father to you?" And she says, "How can I be a better daughter to you?" And she was here. She's never married, but we think it may be coming up. She was here with a fella that she's known since high school. Last week for a visit, we had a meal together, and I asked him, what about her is the most outstanding characteristic? And he said, her humility. And I just thought that was beautiful. And I'm verging a little out of the religious field now, but I think humility, I think it's within Christianity. I think it's what we are to be. And, I'm unable to do a fingertip right now onto a specific religious verse that deals with that. But I want for that girl not only to be feeling a father's love, but to be feeling the love of her maker and that she's special. And so I thank God for the opportunity to do that for her.
You told me your purpose is to serve others, and you're obviously living that, and that's evident by what you're doing. Tell me, just unpack that a little bit more for the listeners. I mean, I think a lot of people say that, but how do you put it into action exactly? How do you remind yourself?
Yeah, I think that, let me go back to that humility for a minute. My dad was a strong proponent of humility, and he would emphasize to me that it is very important to not be touting around the world while you're some big hotshot, and that and I think it kind of ties to faith and religion in that we are here to love one another and love your neighbors yourself. That's what we are told. That's what we're taught all the years in Sunday school and so on. That's what we are to do. And something I get a kick, this is perhaps silly, but in addition to my logo, I oftentimes with many, many clients, I've got a little thing. It looks like a waiter bending over, and it's and put down below it, I remain your humble and most obedient servant. I love doing that. And it's kind of corny and it kind of looks ridiculous. But, you know, you and I have seen ancient letters. And I think Lincoln wrote some letters to that effect. People would write letters like that. I think Ulysses Grant wrote that to Lincoln. But there's somebody else's humble and most obedient servant. And I think I love that phrase. I love that idea. And I've come, after hating the law profession at one time, I've come to think, you know, my gosh, here we are. That's what we are. For the people who come through that door and decide to sign up with us or get assigned to us or however it comes about, we are their servant. And we should be and remain their humble and most obedient servant. And so that they can have that sense. And it is, I would say that is important to me, although I try and do it by actions, not by preaching, not by words, to know that that for those people who might sense that that is what I want to be, that they sense that comes from our having a common maker.
Beautiful. One final question, and I just enjoy talking to you and listening to you. We go on for hours and hours, but you told me finally, John, words to this effect, and my notes are, my handwriting's not that good, but I close everything with I love you, which is, you know, a very concrete, tangible way to put this in action. Tell us more about that.
Well, yeah, you know, my father was a magnificent man. Those words did not come out of his mouth. It just wasn't there. And but my mother, but I felt very loved by my father, always. It's just the verb wasn't there, a verb or noun. But my mother, every single time I left the house, Johnny, I love you. Johnny, love you. Every single written thing, love you. Everything, everywhere, love you, love you, love you. And I am sensitive to the fact that the world's a little sensitive to that, in that the word love gets so associated with romantic love that people get a little skeezy about using it sometimes and so on. But I, with my increasing age, have used it more and more. And I'm finding myself using it more and more and more all the time. I have a friend of like 40 years, it's a female judge in Jackson County, that we practiced law together once upon a time. And so I said to that person,
I know who that is, but that's all right.
Yeah. Yeah. And so I said to that person, within the last year, I said, is it okay if I use the verb love with you? And she said, yes. And so I said, I love you. And with these godchildren, and male and female, I want to emphasize, and with family and so on, I just, Jiminy Christmas. I mean, 1 Corinthians 13 is so magnificently beautiful that I have come to, and this is somewhat recent times, I have come to the point where I cannot say it enough. And because, you know, I'm reminded of, I'm going to make a paraphrase here, so to speak. I remember of Dale Carnegie, who was from Maryville, Missouri, by the way, who wrote How to Win Friends and Influence People. He said, the most beautiful sound to anyone's ear is their own name. Well, I kind of get kind of a kick out of that. But I kind of, the paraphrase I'm thinking of is, you know, the most beautiful expression to a load of people, I can't say everybody, but to a load of people is to be told that they're loved. And I think, good grief, the New Testament, the Old Testament, the Bible, the life of Christ, our Maker's creation of the world, and so on, it was full of love. And so I, for what time I've got left, I want to be a user of the verb and noun love a lot. And so I'll ask people now and then, is it okay if I use that? And then you pick up now and then, so people don't like it. And so I don't want to push it, but I do like it.
Outstanding. Well, picking up on those themes, John Kurtz, thank you. And I usually just stop there, but inspired by your testimony, love you, my friend.
I love you. Mutual. And you and I have been known all these years. I think that's the first time we've exchanged that particular verb, but I feel it's appropriate.
It's appropriate. We've known each other 30-plus years, I'm sure. But
correct.
Thank you so much for your time, John.
Great talking to you, Mike. I respect you.
Great.
Thank you, bud.
Thanks, John.
Thank you very much.
Likewise.
Great talking to you. Bye now.